This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning, everybody. It's nice to see so many familiar faces here. I thought it was a little early in the morning to just start writing on data, so my postdoc wrote this paper that it's basically covers most of what I'm going to be talking about, except for some of the below the knee stuff. So feel free to sit back. You don't have to take notes. All the references are in this paper. You were all given it to you when you checked in. So the title of my talk is Drug-Eluting Stents and Balloons in the SFA and Tibials. What are the data? I think in order to understand the data is to put it into some context on of our existing bare metal stents. And I don't need to go over this. This is these are some of the limitations of our existing portfolio of treatment options in the lower extremity. We need better patency and more complex lesions, longer lesions, obstructions, calcified arteries, and the lesions that we take care of are patients with SFA, popliteal, and tibial problems. Post-PTA restenosis or in-stent restenosis continues to be a problem. We all see this in our practices, and we're all struggling what to do with it. Some patient subgroups are probably more at risk of failure than others, like diabetes and renal failure, but a lot of that risk is conferred with the anatomy. If you want to distill it all down, these are the big three, in my opinion, is where we need innovation and where we need improvement. It's the longer lesions, it's the occlusions versus stenosis, and it's certainly in the distal SFA and popliteal artery, the areas that are under the largest amount of biomechanical stress. These are most of the IDE trials that exist. You may not be able to read that, but the table is in your handout. These are the recent bare metal stent trials, and you can start to see by the average lesion length is that all these trials really cover 5 to 10 centimeter lesions. There's two notable exceptions, the absolute trial, which was the DynaLink stent, and the super trial, which is a smart control stent. They're longer than 10 centimeters, but you know, Saxon and Vartani are going to get up here later this morning and just laugh at this data because what they're going to talk about is 15 to 20 centimeter lesions. You can also see that there's very few occlusions in these trials, again, with the exception of the super trial, and it's distinct among these other trials in that it has a 95% occlusion. When you start looking at the results of these bare metal stent trials, this is what you have. They do pretty well in these short lesions, particularly the newer stents like the Bard or the Protege Everflex stent reflected in the resilient and durability trials. Again, you can see that the longer lesions begin to get at why we need innovation because you have increasing failure with about 50% restenosis rate in some of these longer lesions. And this is the kind of pictures that we all treat. These are occlusions versus stenosis. And these are very challenging because these are probably the most critical patients with lesions down along the distal SFA and popliteal artery. And if you're going to put a stent in here, you're going to have to come into the popliteal artery, which is an area under biomechanical stress. So what's a drug-coated stent? It's a stent platform with a polymer and a drug on it. The polymer really dictates how fast the drug is released over time, and there's various preparations of different polymers. Really, we're in the second generation at this point in time. It's hard to even get first-generation stents, and these are everolimus and zolderlimus on various platforms. The difference in the polymers and the difference in the actual drug dictate how fast the vessel heals. This is a bare metal stent. You see complete endothelialization at just 28 days. And then this is sirolimus, paclitaxel, zolderlimus, and everolimus. And you can kind of see that there's very, very little healing in the early generation drug-coated stents. Just as important as the drug is a polymer, you can look and just... This is just at a glance. You can see the different polymers. A lot of these things are the same things that are in your styrofoam cups or in your car tires. So let's get right into the data. This is the Silver PTX trial. You've all probably heard about this trial. It's sponsored by Cook, and the main hypothesis with that was a Zilver with paclitaxel on it would do better than balloon angioplasty. You can see the results here. There was a second degree of randomization with suboptimal PTA, and those patients could get a provisional bare metal stent or a Zilver PTX stent. We'll show you some of the data here in a minute. These are the patient characteristics, pretty similar to what you all treat. But what I want to really point out is the three components, again, that I was talking about. The length, it's only 5.5 centimeters, so it's very short lesions. The percentage of occlusion is pretty low. And there's really, this is a true SFA trial, not a popliteal or distal SFA trial. Well, these are the results. It's 83% primary patency rate at 1 year with the drug-eluting stent versus about 33% in the balloon angioplasty arm. If the balloon angioplasty required a bailout stent or a provisional stent, it was considered a loss of primary patency. And this is why the PTA arm on this particular trial is lower compared to some of the other PTA trials. Well, if you did get optimal PTA, your patency was about 60%, which is consistent with some of the other trials that we've seen in just plain old balloon angioplasty in the SFA. And this is if you had a provisional bare metal stent. So in either of these cases, in these short lesions, the drug-eluting stent was superior. But when you compare the drug-eluting stent based on this IDE trial with some of the newer generation nitinol stents, it doesn't stand out that much. This is a limitation of the trial. This is how they designed it. This is how the sponsor designed it. It did get FDA approval, but nevertheless, you start looking at the SMART. This is from the STROLL study or the RESILIENT study or some of the durability trials, and longer lesions, just as good a patency. But Cook was smart, and they did a single-arm study, and there's quite a bit of data that we can dig into from some of the single-arm data. So let's look at that. So here's a three-year effectiveness data in primary patency. They did use a peak systolic velocity ratio of 2.0, which is very conservative in my opinion. And with those short lesions, the primary patency rate was 68% in 1 year. And so we kind of scratch our head about that. What does that mean? And the reason why we don't know is there's very little context to put that 68% in, because we don't see three-year stent data very often. I can't remember the last time we've seen it. We do have two-year stent data from the ABSOLUTE trial, and they have a primary patency rate of about 50%. But remember, these patients had twice as long lesions as the Zilver PTX data. So whether if the Zilver PTX was put in a 10-centimeter lesion, whether it would be worse or not, I don't know. But there are some some restenosis catch-up as time goes on in these drug-eluting stents. Well, let's look at the TAS C and D lesion subgroup. This was just came out in 2013, and you can see this is sort of more real world what we're talking about. The lesion length was 22 centimeters. It had 84% occlusions. This is what you and I are treating on a daily basis. And so this is the results. And here we finally might be able to see some of the PTX effect. So in these long lesions, we have superior results with the Zilver PTX as opposed to the ABSOLUTE or these other bare metal stents, also with longer lesions. So whether there's late lumen loss or late restenosis or whether there's a better effect in the longer lesions, we're not really clear based on this data, but certainly it looks like there's a PTX effect in the longer stents, even with a high percentage of occlusions. This is another drug-eluting stent. This is a Dynalink E. It's the same thing as the ABSOLUTE stent, but they put everolimus on it, and they put a lot of everolimus on it. This is 225 micrograms per square centimeter, which is about twice as much as on a drug-coated or a drug-eluting stent in the coronary arteries. Reasonable-sized lesions, 9 centimeters, 45% occlusions. Now, this trial is interesting to me because the 6 months data was excellent. It had nearly 90% patency at 6 months, but a lot of loss down to 68% between 6 and 12 months. So, again, late catch-up of restenosis after the drug wears off. What do you have after the drug is off of a drug-eluting stent? Well, you have a bare metal stent, still susceptible to the motion, the micro-friction, and abrasion in the SFA that these stents are prone to have. By the way, the 6 to 8% at 12 months is exactly what the absolute trial showed with a DynaLink without everolimus on it. Well, let's stay with the Abbott group, and this is we're now slowly going below the knee. This is a Destiny trial. There's three randomized trials: UConn, Destiny, and Achilles trial with below the knee. It's totally a CLI population, very, very short lesions. It's on a Xiens V platform. It's a multi-link vision stent. It's got a 4-0 carbon polymer, which is probably the most biocompatible polymer, if you will, and it's got everolimus on it, and you can see there's an 85% primary patency at 1 year compared to 54% with the bare metal stent. Again, very, very short lesions, though. You can kind of see these are the different stents that you might choose to put below the knee. You can see the strut and the polymer thickness, and the Abbott everolimus stent certainly has the lowest profile. This is another trial. This is the so-called Achilles trial. It used the Cypher Select sirolimus eluting stent. Mean lesion length was 27 millimeters, 80% CTO, and it was a mixed CLI IC population. They did an angiographic endpoint. You can see the flow diagram here. In total, 60% were able to get their angio in the sirolimus arm, and 65% in the bare metal stent arm. And this is the result. Again, a superior result with the sirolimus eluting stent over the plain old balloon angioplasty in this trial. This is a meta-analysis that just came out, and I wanted to show you just because it has all three of the trials. I'm not going to specifically call out the UConn trial, but there's a total of 165 patients treated with these three trials in the drug arm with 33 restenotic events versus 171 patients in the control arm with 71 restenotic events. And in this forest plot, it favors the drug-eluting stent in the below the knee arteries with 80% primary patency rate of all three trials combined in the drug arm versus a little over 50% in the control arm. So, you know, they appear to be safe. It's only 165 patients in the entire world literature in these randomized control trials. I'm not going to go in a lot of, single-center studies. But I think, like the coronary artery, in which drug-eluting stents do not improve patient survival, MI, or major adverse cardiac events, drug-eluting stents in the tibials have really not been shown to increase wound healing or limb salvage or amputations. I think they may be useful when you're doing a 200-centimeter tibial angioplasty, and there's a little area that you want to tidy up. And we do a pretty good job of tidying up lesions to make them look good immediately after we leave the angio suite. Well, let's talk about drug-coated balloons. I think Peter Schneider is going to really touch on this, so I'm be pretty brief about it. But how is drug-coated balloons different than drug-eluting stents? And there's some really I think important differences that are important to consider when you look at possible failure modes and also possible areas where we can improve on them. So the drug concentration on the drug-eluting stents is pretty low. Overall, it's about 5 to 10 micrograms per millimeter. But the drug-coated balloons, because of the way they deliver their drug, which is all at once at a one-time inflation, it has to be very high. And you've got to consider that when you think about some of the lesions you might be treating, multiple inflations, multiple balloons, how are these going to be tolerated? The transfer at the time of deployment is slow. The transfer from the drug-coated stent is solely by the polymer, with the exception being the Zilver PTX, which has laser fine little laser holes in it. But the polymer, in general, in most stents, allows the drug to elute over time, a specified time range. And they can adjust that by adjusting the relative density or composition or thickness of the polymer. but in the drug code of balloon, it's all at once. It's within inflation. Mathematically, we call it a delta function. It all goes in at one time, and it's zero in every other way. The drug retention in the tissues, it can only be short term with the drug eluting stents, but with a drug coated balloon, the drug needs to partition off the balloon surface rapidly and then be retained in the tissues in order for them to work. Really intuitively, it doesn't make sense that they should work because you give the drug and then the whole reservoir of where the drug is gone. Probably one of the most inefficient ways to deliver a drug, in my opinion. Diffusion has to be pretty good off of a stent. Has to be excellent from a drug-coated balloon. The more lipophilic, the faster it partitions off the balloon surface, the better. So those are the main differences of drug-coated balloons and drug-eluting stents. Despite it not being quite intuitive to any of us why these should work, there's a lot in development, and I'll point out to a certain. A couple examples momentarily, but primarily the Medtronic Invetech and the Lutonix seem to have the most traction here in the United States. I just pulled this off the Medtronic website, and you can look and see that the drug-coated balloons, they don't have polymers. They have basically spacers to allow the drug to be evenly distributed along the balloon, and this is an example of the Medtronic line, which Medtronic acquired the Invetech inventory of balloons, and they use paclitaxel, and they use urea as an excipient. Most of these are very hydrophilic. Some examples use radio contrast agent, but most of them use some kind of water-soluble spacer for the drug. And this is just an example. You can see the balloon here, and the blue is the paclitaxel and the urea spacers. I think that there's a lot of interest of the Lutonix, which is the Levant One. It's paclitaxel and amoxi balloon. They just got acquired from Bard for $225 million. And this was at closing with another $100 million paid out at the time of the PMA. So there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of fervor generated over this right here. These drug-coated balloons. In the dark red is the drug-coated balloons, and in the lighter red or the pink is the plain old balloon angioplasty. On the y-axis, that's in millimeters, and this is the so-called late lumen loss, which has somehow become conventional with the drug-coated balloons, and it's not entirely without merit. I think that it's an old endpoint that they used to use when they were doing coronary balloon angioplasty alone. But anyway, this is the length of the lesions being treated in these various trials, and this is a percent occlusions. And you can see that the late lumen loss in nearly all these trials is much less than the plain old balloon angioplasty. You don't see a red bar in the impact trial because it's actually negative. It's just a small little line right there. And in the impact so-called pacifier trial, where they used a Pacific balloon with paclitaxel on it, the vessel, what that means is the vessel actually got a little bit larger. But when you look at the 6 months target lesion revascularization, you can see all the different trials. The first thing I want you to notice is that in the drug-coated balloon trials, there's not that many patients in either one of these trials, pacifier, debellum, Levant 1. I don't have Levant 2 on here, but there's also a lot of bailout stenting. I think one of the most realistic real-world trials is the Debellum Registry, and that's a drug-eluting balloon in multi-level disease in the lower extremity, and you can see that there's 57% and 56% bailout stenting or provisional stenting. And if your idea is to leave nothing behind, which is some of the drug-coated balloons, what they're advocating, you're still going to have a considerable amount of patients that require stenting. Is this where it's going to be as we roll these things out in the United States? Well, I'm not sure. I think it's going to be somewhere between 30% and 50%, if I had to guess. This is just one study I want to highlight. This is the so-called Italian registry. This is a Medtronic study. It's part of the impact. And you can see that the lesion length was 7 centimeters, 34% occlusions. But you're starting to get into some popliteal vascular territories, which is where I believe that these balloons will gain some traction. They actually use duplex ultrasound for a peak systolic velocity ratio of 2.4 to define binary restenosis. And you can look and see the primary patency rate in these moderate lesions was 87% at 6 months and 83% at 12 months with a 12% stent rate. So that's not too bad. It's an endpoint other than late lumen loss, and we can kind of use this to compare to get some other plain old balloon angioplasty trials, which remember from the Zilver PTX data was about 65-66% in their optimal angioplasty arm. So these are my conclusions from the existing data. I think that metal implants have a distinct disadvantage of inducing excessive intimal hyperplasia. It's due to movement, microevasion, abrasion, and inflammation. With motion, it's just as simple as walking. I'm not talking about exercise or anything else. Can a combination of toxic drugs and metal improve the results? Well, I think for the short term, yes, especially in the longer lesions like we saw in the TAS C and D from the Zilver PTX trial. Long term, we'll be confronted with increasing failure and increasing stent fracture as all DESs become bare metal stents and late restenosis catch up, as I highlighted, is a concern. Drug coated balloons is a simple technology. It's not a new technology, it's an old technology. Jeff Isner in Boston was spray painting VEGF on balloons in 1993 and using them. So it's nothing new here. The acute results will show a high rate of failure, particularly in the long or complex lesions like we saw in the Debellum study. Elastic recoil and constrictive remodeling will remain a problem. And really right now, at least in the literature that I have access to, we have less than 500 patients with 6 months data. Certainly Peter Schneider can tell us more about this as he's one of the PIs of the America IMPACT trial. Drug-coated balloons will also show a high rate of failure in the long term as drug distribution is certainly not even. With the composition of the SFA, fibrocalcific plaque, Munkenberg's medial calcific sclerosis, dissections, eddy currents, this all impact the even distribution of drug within the artery. However, one can repeat the procedure, particularly if you're not putting a stent in. And I'm not even sure you can use them. I'm not even sure putting a stent in is such a terrible thing because perhaps you can use them after you put the stent in, as they did in the Debellum trial. Improvements in drug-coated balloons are still required to achieve better drug distribution and longer duration to prevent early restenosis and distal emboli. Maybe it's a combination of drug-coated balloon and spot stenting, or plaque tacking may be the answer, and hopefully Peter can shed some light on that. These are some of my thoughts. I think it's a really exciting time to be involved in peripheral intervention. I think vascular surgeons have been lagging behind in the innovation and leadership in these trials. I think we can make a difference. The Z's technologies become available. We have to decide whether they're worth the cost and how they're going to fit into what we have existing. I believe we're really just at the beginning of the peripheral drug delivery era. We're currently using broad-spectrum, non-specific drugs. In the future, we'll have more rationally designed agents, more harmonious with the known biology, maybe controlled or timed-release agents. And we certainly need more efficient delivery mechanisms. The science is way behind the medical-industrial complex. And I think as costs soar, there will be a correction and catch-up of the science. This is particularly where vascular surgeons can come in. We can develop innovative programs using skill sets that are really natural to us. Early phase drug delivery programs, preclinical expertise, and device innovation, both at individual and society levels, can make a significant difference in moving this young field. And I still think that the most exciting and significant advances are yet to be discovered. So thank you very much for your attention, and thank you, Dr. Conti. For the introduction.
So in my estimation, what's happening now is really one of the most exciting things that's happened in my career. And this is how I see it. So the last, let's just say 20 years ago, it was, could we do it any other way? That is, could we do it endo? The past 10 years, endo's just been getting better and better. From a technical standpoint, but not from a basic scientific standpoint. And now I think we're about to enter a new phase because the potential to combine biologics with the tools of daily use, I think, could put us on another plateau that's above where we've been, where we've been getting the same results year in and year out with some of our more routine procedures and been rather frustrated by it. So my personal opinion is that the drug-coated balloon era is going to be big. I think it is going to be a transitionary time frame, and it's going to make us re-question a lot of the stuff that we've been assuming for the past few years. So if I could just ask you to take yourself back for just a minute to say the early stent era. We had several years where, at least in my career, where we did balloon angioplasties primarily for focal iliacs and focal SFAs, and it was really just too nerve-wracking to try to tackle more occlusive or longer or more severe lesions because we didn't have the stents. And then when the stents came along, every angioplasty we did, we really tortured ourselves at the bedside. Do we stent? Do we not? Let's get another angle. Let's re-balloon. Let's try it this way. Let's try it that way. All in this effort to avoid stent implantation. Finally, stents got good enough, reproducible enough. You could see them. You could deploy them easily. And then we just started to assume, hey, I don't like the way that looks. Stent. That's the answer. Now we're entering a new phase where we're going to have to go back and reevaluate all those things that we were thinking about in the early stent era. Does it really need a stent? Because in my opinion, when you use a drug-coated balloon and then follow it with a stent, you are in a mode of self-defeatation, treated segment does not want to have a stent once you put your drug-coated balloon on that segment. So that brings us to the topic of today and this concept of, is there anything that we can do to improve plain old balloon angioplasty? And one of those things may be bioabsorbable stents, and there may be a couple of other possibilities. But I think the key thing is that this is going to be an exciting time because it's going to force us to do the intellectual exercise that we skipped over once stents got good. Now we can't, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything seems like it needs to be nailed down. And this is now changing the game a little bit, adding biologics. So at the present time, the location and severity of the disease in the lower extremity determines the type of reconstruction. And in the SFA, it's largely task-driven, and in the below-the-knee arteries, it's largely driven by other things, Rutherford class, that is tissue damage, angiosomal anatomy, and runoff. So it's really driven by different things, whether it's above the knee or below the knee. And this issue of task classification is just a code word for something that Chris referred to several times, and that is the severity of the lesion and what you need to do because it's so severe. And right now, above the knee, this is currently an implant-based area. We typically come away with an implant when all is said and done, whereas below the knee, we're still balloon-based. So just going back to an accumulation in this Viva OPC where the balloon arm from multiple trials using raw data were combined to look to see what the patency at 12 months is for balloon angioplasty alone, somewhere between 28% and 38%. And if you think about what's actually happening on the balloon to artery surface area, it's just amazing to me that this works at all. And yet, you know, the first peripheral balloon angioplasty done by Grunzig in 1974, so next year will be the 40th anniversary, and this is being done in every lab, in every hospital, in every country in the world, balloon angioplasty. Turns out that balloon angioplasty in this setting all by itself doesn't get that great of results, but it gives us something to build on. And when we try to build on it, there are multiple different directions that we could go. But the basic mechanism of balloon angioplasty is to take a highly irregular, partially calcified, heterogeneous surface that's really hard in some areas and really soft in other areas, and then to put equal pressure in all directions in a circumferential manner. The pressure increases until it overwhelms the lesion, and then through some little bit of compression of the plaque, but mostly plaque fracture, the lumen sizes increase. So where in your life, when you deal with a difficult, heterogeneous, unpredictable, maybe a little harder over here, a little softer over there, do you then apply equal pressure in all directions and expect to get a really smooth result? Well, in fact, you don't in this case either. I mean, that's just not how life works. And what ends up happening is we get these unpredictable, hopefully mostly longitudinal, these unpredictable flaps. The other thing is that when the lesion gives way, the pressure, which has been overstocked within the balloon, propagates down the artery, and this is one of the reasons why we have longitudinal tears after balloon angioplasty. So these are just some examples of post-angioplasty dissection in the tibial arteries, the above-knee popliteal arteries, and in the SFA. They come in so many different shapes and sizes. We still don't know at this point as a field which ones need some type of mechanical support and which ones don't. I firmly believe that some do. But you can also see from the wide variety of different stent rates within different trials that some of that is that there are a little bit different lesions in the trial, but a lot of it is the doctor's view of what looks like a dangerous result and what doesn't. So when we recanalize atherosclerotic arteries, balloon angioplasty provides uncontrolled dissection. It is minimally invasive, and we like that, but there are some problems that are raised. The plaque is not molded but dissected away, so that the potential to have tissue actually prolapsing into the lumen, which is, of course, what we're thinking about when we're looking at a post-PTA angiogram, that a significant portion of the lumen could be taken up with a tissue flap. And we know that there's a variety of bailout stent rates, and Chris covered these, but in the major prospective nitinol stent trials that have been done in the past 10 years that have led to the approval of multiple devices, the stent rate or the need for bailout in the balloon arm has been between 35 and 50%, and this has been primarily task A and task B lesions. And as has been said, as we move on to a real-world practice where we start to get away from doing lots and lots of A's and B's and on to doing C's and D's, the heavily calcified, the ones that extend to the popliteal, the ones that are long occlusions, the potential then for more need for focal mechanical support will increase. So again, here's just some of these stent trials, and you can see that they're all in the category of A and B, and that they had a certain stent bailout rate. Now, the stent bailout rate, keep in mind, is sort of as beauty is in the eye of the beholder. In other words, it's at the discretion of the operator. And sometimes, culturally, this is my guess, is that culturally, in the future, as we get used to drug-coated balloons, we'll have a lower threshold for leaving something alone. In other words, we'll look at a finished result and say, you know, that's probably okay, even though we may not have objective data to say. The trouble is really with task C and D lesions, and we know from experience, and you've seen all these papers, that when you compare them, that the task C and D patients, and especially the D, do much worse with respect to primary patency, long-term limb salvage, in a variety of manners. And this is an interesting study here where they looked at what happened when a task A and B or a task C and D patient went on to have a failed SFA intervention. And what they found was that when a C and D type patient goes on to failure, the consequences are greater, more likely to occlude, more likely to lose runoff, more likely to extend the length of the continuous diseased segments. So it tells us a little bit more about this particular population and gives us a little bit of food for thought about what we might be able to do about it. My sense is that the drug-coated balloon model is going to make a huge impact on our practice. It won't be right away. In Europe, drug-coated balloons have been available since 2007. I predict that the soonest that we'll have drug-coated balloons in the periphery is 2008, 2015, give or take a year. But what's happening here is a study that's done to show the incredible dynamism, the ability of the femoral popliteal segment to elongate, to lengthen, and to change position dramatically depending on how the person is positioned. So these are all different individuals, and these are all measurements made in those same individuals. And look at this one. Between just by bending the leg, there's a huge difference when the fempop and SFA arteries are elongated out and measured. And, I just don't think stents can keep up with that, personally. And this is part of the problem that we face, is that once you put in a stent, the stent has to assume the configuration of the artery. And I think that what's happening, at least in my opinion, once the stent is in place, and of course the only time the patient is ever straight is when they're laying on your OR table, and the whole rest of their life they're walking upstairs or they're twisted up in a pretzel while they're getting a good night's sleep. And that stent is rubbing back and forth in a sort of a micro-friction fashion against the artery. Now, probably some of them are well incorporated, but I bet many are not. And we've all seen this famous rendition or one like it to help us feel better, to help us explain why our stents in the SFA and POP don't work as well as they should. But what about this? Here's a case. I'm doing a long segment SFA recanalization. I get into the healthier artery distally. I stent right down into that healthier distal segment. And when the recurrent stenosis comes back, it involves that healthier segment now that never had any lesion there and now is only a stent. And this patient is responding to the stent. So with stents, you get effective apposition of dissected plaque to expand the lumen wall, but there are lots of problems. The foreign body, the rigidity, the trauma-related issues, restenosis, etc. And really the bottom line is that no one would volunteer for a full metal jacket. And if that's the case, maybe we should work backward from there and say, hey, what's the least amount of metal that we could use to provide just the least amount of mechanical support for those lesions? And we know they're out there, especially the task C and Ds and the ones that start out as occlusions. Those lesions are going to need some kind of support. And the question is there any possible way that we could minimize that? So I believe that we're putting in too much metal, that we have too much outward force being exerted, that what we're looking for on the inside is tissue apposition, not scaffolding, and not overstiffening. So we have balloon angioplasty and stents, but my sense is that there's a middle ground. There's some place in the middle here where we might be able to add a few things like bioabsorbable or spot treatment that might be able to extend this paradigm in a pleasing way and have it give a good result for our patients. So I do think we could improve our technique with balloon angioplasty, and there's a little bit of data on this in the literature. I'm not going to waste your time with it, and it's pretty old, but there is some data to suggest that if you use a single balloon that covers the entire lesion, you blow the balloon up slowly, and you keep the balloon up for a couple of minutes, and then let the balloon down slowly, that you will have fewer dissections. And my sense is that one of the reasons why cryoplasty resulted in fewer dissections is that cryoplasty, because it was had a CO2 canister, it gave a very uniform dilation of the lesion. It could possibly have been due to the cold temperature, but it also could have been due to the way it was dilated. And that was pretty well documented, fewer dissections with cryoplasty. Now, what about bioabsorbable vascular scaffolds? Well, the primary company that's working on this is Bard. There's some public information out there. I love the concept, nothing of leaving no implant behind. Of course, the issues around it are significant, though, because you have the rigidity of the system of getting a bioabsorbable stent just into the right place. You have some specific products, PLLA, which is what Abbott is using, versus metal alloy magnesium, which is what Biotronic has used. And I'll just show you some early results. This is a porcine coronary artery showing the difference between bioabsorbable vascular scaffold and Cypher without really any difference. And this is the result of a couple of clinical trials. This is the Perseus trial, which ended up in a 50% restenosis rate at 6 months. And this is the AMS Insight using the bioabsorbable magnesium-based stent. So although the primary patency of these has not been good, the real issue is what will happen in this trial, the Esprit trial, where the Abbott company feels that they have at least made significant progress in developing this bioabsorbable and also drug-eluting vascular scaffold. And this will go into the Absorb trial. It's enrolling right now. They're also using it in an Absorb BTK. So we're going to know a lot more within a year on that. And then lastly, I just wanted to show you another concept. This is something I'm working on, so it's a total conflict of interest. But just another potential iteration in this zone of how one might really minimize the metal while acknowledging the fact that some lesions will require focal mechanical support. So it's really like a little clip or a tack that does where the business end is in the middle. It's very short as it lays along the length of the artery. It has hinges, and it has very low outward force in comparison to standard stents. And the outward force, you can see, is kind of horizontal, which means that you can take it into a tapering system, and it would exert the same outward force. You don't have that same worry about oversizing that we would if we just took one long stent and went into a tapering artery. And so I think, and this is just kind of the concept of it, of where you have this dissection and you can put this focal mechanical support and end up with a good result. I think, and this is my last case here, and one way that something like this could be used. So this is a popliteal occlusion in a young woman that was crossed subintimally. And as what usually happens, the entry site and the reentry site were the places where the trouble was on this long subintimal. So what they did then was they used focal mechanical support, a couple of tacks at the entry and a couple of tacks at the reentry, so that what they were able to do was to tack down these areas so that those flaps weren't there. So rather than putting one long stent across it, they used focal support. Not quite as good as no metal, but I think if you need metal, there's potential for other solutions. So in summary, what we need to do is minimize injury. And if we can minimize injury using a variety of effects, and I know Chris's research is really all about figuring out ways to minimize injury, and I think he's really on the right track. But we also need something that's versatile. And the challenge now is to come up with something that's workable on a daily basis. I do think our current paradigms with angioplasty and stents, I think we've gone as far as we can go with those. And I think we're ready for a change and some potential for improvement based on either other designs, but more likely on biologic agents that are added to existing tools. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.